All right, everybody, it is time for another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. But before we dive in to our awesome, awesome guest and conversation today, I want to remind you guys of two things. And the first one is that if you go to crypto101insider.com, you can join our private community. Here's where we have our model portfolio and all of our top picks. We also have Crypto 101 University, where we have hours and hours and hours of written and video content that explains blockchain and explains cryptocurrency in a very bite-sized and easy to understand way. And we have a weekly newsletter that goes out and quarterly state of crypto addresses that go out. There is just a ton of value packed into this every which way. So I want you guys first to go to crypto101insider.com today, if you haven't already. I also want to remind you guys that Pizza Mind and I recently just finished a book. It took 11 months of our lives to write, and we're calling it Crypto Revolution, Your Guide to the Future of Money. We walk you through this fascinating world of cryptocurrencies and blockchain, and it's part history book, it's part instructional guide, and it's going to really show you guys why cryptocurrencies are globally disruptive and how they're going to actually change in real life and in real terms the way that we buy and sell and even live. We include a bunch of how-tos on getting started with your first exchanges. We give you tips on how to safely buy and sell and store cryptocurrencies, as well as how do we evaluate potentially good cryptocurrencies. And the best part of the book is that we're giving it away for free. All you have to do is pay for shipping and handling. So go to cryptorevolution.com and pick up your copy today. All right, everyone. Happy Tuesday or Thursday, whenever you're listening to this podcast. You guys know we do two a week. We're excited to be here, guys. I'm not joined by my notorious co-host today, Mr. Pizza Mind. He is traveling the world. He's at Cosmoverse in Colombia currently, learning about the Atom ecosystem and all the good things there. But we're going to dive into the Ethereum ecosystem with the head economist of Consensus, Lex Sokolin. Lex, welcome to the show. There's a lot of ground to cover.
Oh boy, yeah, let's do it. Thanks for having me.
Lex, you've got a killer background. We were just catching up before the show, and you worked at Lehman, you worked at Deutsche, you worked at Barclays, you were there on Wall Street during the past 2008 great financial crisis. You saw the inner workings, you saw how it all unfolded and how it resonated. And, you were saying that there are some troubling signs in the economy currently, which I think everybody could understand on a very high level. But we're going to kind of dive into that. Particularly, this week we're recording this and there was a huge government led intervention or a central bank led intervention onto the UK bonds, the 30-year bonds, and you're very familiar with the UK debt markets and all sorts of stuff, and so I really don't know how to start this one. I'm typically not stumped, but there are so many different avenues we can take it. Lex, what's the first thing that's on your mind right now as we're in this market environment?
Dollars, you can get 4% on your dollar if you put it into a certificate of deposit. That's, I would say,
pretty sexy.
You should think about that. Getting 4% on your savings, backed by the FDIC, is a pretty good DeFi yield. You can yield farm American inflation. I'm just gonna go into sort of dark humor the whole time. What's the thing on my mind? I mean, there's like a lot of detail, but before and instead of maybe getting into the detail, it's helpful to just parse some stuff into categories. The first is the difference between like an operating economy, or in crypto, it might be like a protocol that is doing things that are literally productive, like making products that people buy and pay for, or other people put labor into and sell, or access to some machine, some sort of DeFi machine, Uniswap or something like that, where there's a consumer benefit and somebody's willing to pay for that benefit through a price, you know. And when you add up all of those microeconomic interactions between businesses or projects or DAOs and then buyers of those products, you end up getting into an aggregate economy. So when you buy a sandwich, it's an operating economy. The thing is real. You got to eat. You're happy to pay for the labor and for the sandwich, and it's delicious. That's different from the financial services sector and capital markets. It's related to it. The financial services sector controls parameters that can influence the operating economy. If I yank interest rates so high, your mortgage triples, you're probably not going to be spending a lot of money on sandwiches, or maybe you are, who knows? But the point being is, you know, it depends on the sandwich, like how much avocado is in there. It's like grilled cheese, you know, if a law school dropout is putting it together, like there's lots of different variables on sandwiches. But the main point is, there are things that are financial crises. There are things that are a result of the engineering of the capital markets. Like derivatives and stuff, but also things like bonds or things like quantitative easing or things like a government saying, we're going to buy up all the bonds of this maturity, because if we don't, then the credit default swaps are going to be this expensive or collapse or whatever. The obligations will go this way or that way. And there are lots of links between the financial system, which in the good case lubricates the economy and makes it grow. And in the bad case, crashes everything down, puts people out of jobs, into recessions, breaks businesses and so on. And so I think this distinction, you can see it now in the world. Like you can see the financial crisis that the United Kingdom is going into, you know, for a number of reasons, but one of the depreciation of the currency, right? You can pause here and say, like, the cost of energy is going up because of war, of the invasion, and the actual things going on in the world. That's like an economic problem on the ground. But then that has implications for lots of financial things on top. So you have inflation, and then because of the inflation, central banks are adjusting their interest rates. But the UK interest rates aren't as being adjusted as fast as the American interest rates. And so the pound is less valuable. And then there's the reserve currency issues and the fiscal policy issues. And so you have these financial kind of follow-on effects, these derivative effects that are separate from like how well or how productive stuff really is. And that can get really complicated and confusing. And it's also a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that's kind of That's one thing I wanted to lay out. And then the second thing to lay out is like the opinions and feelings that people have about the philosophy of Web3 or traditional finance, or like if you work at Facebook, are you a good person or not? If you work at Google, or if you work at Goldman Sachs or Wells Fargo, are you a good person? If you work at Compound or Maker, like, you know, like people have lots of emotions and feelings about what tribe they're in. And they similarly have these feelings about the assets they hold. So somebody might hold bank stocks because they think they're going to get dividends, or they might hold crypto assets because they think the fiat system's dead, or they might hold interest rate assets because they want the yield and they're creating some sort of play there. And they'll create stories about, you know, I'm a person like this and my asset is good because I hold it. And that's a nice behavioral bias.
Yeah.
Think about it this way. You go out and you buy a mug and you have a mug for 5 years, and then you see the same mug new in a different store. you don't want the new mug. You want your mug because it's special and it's valuable to you. And there's exactly. Yeah. So, and that's a human kind of behavioral attribute. And it's the same thing with assets. However, what we see after the last year is that everything is still correlated and is plugged into the macro economy. Like the Web3 space is disruptive and different and has different internal dynamics in the way that bonds are different from equities, you know, and fintech is different from biotech, but the correlations are all going to one. Like all the assets are moving in the same way. And the reason for that is you and me. You might hold a share of Apple and a share of JP Morgan and some Bitcoin and also some Uniswap, right? And when you need cash to buy the sandwich or to pay your higher mortgage or your rent, you know, all of it, or buy gas or whatever, you're going to be selling your assets and the prices of the assets are going to go down as a result. And so I think one of the main things that I've been focused on is understanding much better how the global environment filters to crypto, and then how the crypto environment filters to the fundamentals of Web3, which is what, you know, Consensus is working on, standing up, and is really engaged in.
Yeah, damn. That's incredible. And before we kind of dive into Web3 infrastructure, I want to just kind of tie a nice little bow on the failing pension funds, and like, how do they shore up their defenses? How do governments shore up their defenses? I saw Japan was selling USD, buying a bunch of Japanese yen in order to shore up their defenses. Are there, how do they not have their liabilities collapse in on themselves?
I mean, everything's kind of relative to the spending and the balance sheets of the different banks. Mm. I mean, one of the strange takeaways for me this time around is actually like how much the central bank playbook is like a protocol treasuries playbook. You know, like watching Terra collapse because of its recursive logic. This thing is backed by this thing, and this thing is there because it's part of the same protocol. And if the other thing goes up, then this thing's valuable. You know, and the moment somebody realizes, wait, that's a circle, that's a self-reference, like the whole thing just turns into a bank run. And you realize that the little economic experiments that protocols have been designing with their currencies are actually the Fed's got the same playbook. Like, issuing or minting the dollar, and you can mint, you can print the dollar or burn the dollar through treasury operations and so on.
Protocol treasury operations.
Federal US Reserve. U.S. Well, Federal Reserve operations, right? If you're buying treasuries or selling treasuries, you're essentially doing the same thing with the money supply. Anyway, the mechanics are really analogous, and also like you actually do have the same circular issues of like you have the Fed, which is trying to financially engineer an economy, and it can't because the economy is what creates the economy, not the financial engineering. And and it's like, well, what is the money backed by the economy? How does the economy grow? Through interest rates. What are interest rates? Interest rates are like the financial engineering of the money, which is so it's the same sort of same thing. But to answer your question a bit more specifically, central banks have balance sheets on which they have currencies of other countries. So, for example, the United Kingdom has about 110 billion US dollars. You know, as a reminder, Terra was 40 billion. So 110 billion of US dollars is not that much. The Bank of Japan, I think, has a lot more. And it's not a trillion, but it's I think in the hundreds of billions, multiple hundreds of billions, and they spent $25 billion selling the dollar, buying up their own currency, in order to defend the value of their own currency. Now, if they draw down their whole balance sheet and they can no longer sell the dollar, then that's what breaking the bank is. That's what Soros did to the Bank of England. Like, they're holding a peg above the natural kind of market clearing place. And then when they run out of quote unquote dry powder, i.e. capital, they will no longer be able to, again, quote, defend it. But there, you know, and then you get into all sorts of things like, well, we're going to borrow in order to defend the peg, or we're going to issue debt to ourselves or to the IMF or whatever. You know, so there's lots of sort of ways for other actors to help absorb some of this. And it's a bizarre moment because the US is essentially tank. The US, the sort of policy decisions of the US over the last 6 months are really destabilizing the developed world in a profound way. Like, Norway is having a currency crisis regardless of like its fiscal policies. Like, it's the dollar being so strong and having such higher interest rates relative to other currencies and sort of relatively having higher growth is maybe good for the US, but not so great for everybody else.
Yeah, it's definitely sucking liquidity from all the emerging markets, and it just gets more expensive for their cost of living. I mean, we think we have it tough here in America. Our main export is inflation to other countries, basically.
It's not just cost of living, right? It's like, let's say I'm a business and I pay my costs in dollars because I'm consuming some technology service or some commodity or whatever. So I have inflation in dollar terms, plus I've devalued my currency 30%. So now my costs have gone up 50%. Now the government of my country realizes this and starts generating fiscal policies like, we're going to pay for the electricity of, you know, every business over this amount, which makes the fiscal policy of that particular country worse and the currency even worse, which continues to push on that cycle. So it's, you know, I think in real time, very alarming what's going on.
Yeah. And then I also read at the end of 2021, so we don't have updated numbers through 2022, but at the end of 2021, 85% roughly of world trade was denominated in and facilitated in the dollar. And so that's pretty crazy to consider. Because whenever a market move happens in the dollar, it does ripple out and touch every other economy, whether you want it or not. And I think that, like, you know, the BRICS, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, like, they're trying to de-dollarize the world because they see this. And they're like, well, let's start to, you know, denominate trade between us in rubles or in yen and all that kind of stuff, or won, I mean. Do you see that as an actual threat to de-dollarizing the world? You know, that's, you know, one of the maybe impetuses for Putin's invasion to de-dollarize the world, because it does have such a strong grip and it does, you know, kind of hurt all these other countries.
I hesitate to speculate into the mind of Putin, in large part because he's, you know, he's so impregnable. I do think de-dollarization, though, is certainly a real vector of change. And I think that for, especially in Asia, it is important for China to get off the dollar in some way as that economy grows and as they extend their influence into Africa and the Asian region and so on. And I think if you actually do look at the trade in the region, it has been the share of dollar trade has been going down. I don't think that the Ukrainian invasion is for that purpose in particular. And the other thing to say is, if you're in the States, you can't be like America First about it. It's not good for you. For some very obvious reasons, like, let's say you hold look at the S&P 500. Okay, of those companies in the S&P 500, how many have a global P&L? Like, many, right?
Probably most. Yeah,
If you want Apple to be failing, if you want Amazon to be failing, if you want Facebook to be failing, then you would think that it's sort of that the current economic environment kind of doesn't matter. But if you think about these global companies, which are larger than nation states in many ways, they have a global footprint. And so healthy spending in Europe, right? Like you don't want consumer discretionary to fail across all of Europe and then for all of their kind of social policies to fail and have to get refinanced and default on loans. Like that's going to tank the stock market in the US and, you know, all the retirement portfolios of everybody who needs to be able to survive on like 401k income or whatever. And then you're reducing people's assets into inflation and into higher priced goods. So there's lots of these recursive loops, and you know, it's hard to draw direct lines because there's so many different dependencies, but it's a very odd time. And you know, like you can see this when you go down to the crypto world and you see things like when you would see, you know, Olympus DAO trying to get other DAO tokens into protocol liquidity, into their treasury, or you see lots of protocols trying to diversify, but everything falls down together. It's because you're all in the same ecosystem. You're not diversifying. You're like literally running on the same platform for the same users, right? So, if somebody, let's say somebody's holding Compound token and the Compound token falls 70% in value, well, they're not going to be super excited to be trading on Uniswap and generating fees for Uniswap. And, you know, so like the interconnection that you see in the world is the same interconnection that you see within the blockchain protocol assets as well.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good kind of jumping off point for our transition to our conversation about DeFi a little bit here. And DeFi's changed a lot since it kind of, I don't know, I don't even know when you could say it first came out, but you know, I remember there, you know, DeFi yield farming summer of 2020. And then everybody was, you know, kind of on the whole boat of protocol owned liquidity with, you know, Tokamak and Olympus DAO. And, you know, there was the recursive lending. You know, and all of it kind of proved to be a flash in the pan, these subsidies that run out, these kind of unsustainable models. One thing that I'm particularly excited, and you'll see I'm wearing my MakerDAO shirt right here that I got at the Ethereum conference in 2018 or something like that. I'm really excited about real world assets being married to the blockchain. So being able to tokenize accounts receivables or some, you know, cash flows from a coal mine or whatever, tokenize that and be able to have people finance real world assets on the blockchain. And I think that could be kind of the next stage of sustainable DeFi yields. And what's kind of your vision here of the future of DeFi?
So there's a lot of parts to that question. And I think that all of it was productive. You know, like I think about the ICO boom and the ICO collapse. And then I think about the DeFi boom and the DeFi collapse. And same for NFTs and PFPs and so on.
Right.
And I think each one is a wave coming in and a wave going out. And every time the wave goes in further and doesn't go out as far and then goes in further and so on, right? So ICOs were just venture capital decks on the internet that try to raise money. And then DeFi was and is a very functional system. I mean, it is a financial system. Provides payments, provides banking, provides trading, provides investing, provides asset allocation, insurance, and so on. That is, I mean, it's a miracle.
nothing short of a miracle.
Yeah, it is a miracle that these applications work. They work at scale. You know, whatever it was, 250 billion or 150 billion, depending on which chains you count. But like, that's a financial industry, right? That's not like it's a business without market cap. That's a financial industry. And so I do think that is, that we should appreciate the fact that it is functional software and that it works. And every time that the wave goes back out, it moves closer, you know, like people start talking about, well, it's not Bitcoin, it's blockchain, or it's not ICOs, it's security tokens, you know. And now I think we're in this place where it's like, where it's not on-chain native tokens of DAOs, it's real world assets, right? So you have like a poetry to this. It's a it goes back and forth. It's a dialectic. And I think it's, you know, it's very reasonable to be excited about bringing more assets on chain, but there are a lot of barriers to doing it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's easier to, you know, like for the internet, do you want to be Google focused on creating search on top of internet native content? Do you want to be YouTube creating a platform for web 2 user generated videos? Or do you want to be like a company that's building the, and I hate using the analogy, but building the intranet for a large enterprise? Do you want to be the company that's taking a movie studio and trying to build Hulu to compete with YouTube using, you know, like traditional content in the middle of 2008? And the answer is probably not. You probably want to be focused on how do you create native economic value in the emerging platform. There is a ton of value in taking the prior stuff and moving it into the new platform. There's a ton of value in that. It just, in my mind, it follows rather than leads, you know? And so that's why the question for me has been, we had a wave, which was just the concept space, which is ICOs. Then we had a wave that was just a financial engineering, like a financial industry implementation. And that failed because there was very little operating economy underneath. Now, the next wave must have an operating economy, because once you have a Web3 economy that people can commit their labor there and make a living and then use that to live their life in the real world and the digital world, then DeFi is just the banking system for Web3. You know, yeah. And it's that starts to come together. More financial engineering about different kinds of assets, I mean, it's cool. And I think we need to erode at the regulatory barriers. And I think the collapse of yield farming also makes people a lot more reasonable about risk return. You know, so you might get excited about a 15% interest rate and on a supply chain projects per year. You know, you might not be looking for 1,000% APR that is just a pyramid scheme. And so I do think there will be a cultural change that is productive, but it's still, to me, consequent to answering the question of like, if Web3 really exists and if we take it seriously, what is the productive economic activity that is native to it? And how do we grow that?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And so at Consensus, you know, are you guys, you know, kind of trying to stimulate those kind of, you know, real world productive DAOs? And is there kind of a lot of resistance there to adoption of these sort of productive economies? Or are you seeing quite some, you know, success there?
Yeah, so Consensus does two things from a product perspective. You know, we had our start as a venture studio, but that the company has shifted a lot over the years, and the venture activities are all part of a company called Consensus Mesh, which is the former portfolio, and there's Ethereal Ventures, which makes investments, and then Consensus, the kind of the main brand, focuses on two things. The first is getting developers to build in Web3 and giving them the tools to create things. And so that's Infura. That's, you know, so being able to connect into a protocol and execute software. That's Truffle, being able to write software. That's building the protocol itself. So we've done a lot contributing to the merge and to kind of pushing forward protocol design. And so getting developers and entrepreneurs to build stuff is kind of one side of it. And then the other side of it is getting people to use the things that the creators build. So of course, you know, MetaMask and making sure that people can actually access and interact with all the different applications that are built. So that you know, if the Web3 economy grows, all the stuff that I've described is going to grow. And the Web3 economy can only grow if you have more developers building more stuff, and then if you have more people, individuals using the stuff. You know, people and corporations, because corporations are people too. Right. So the one bit to amend that is we've taken a lot more, we've been a lot more purposeful recently about crypto economics, and that's my focus. And in particular around token engineering, decentralization, and governance. You know, so we've started being quite active as a delegate in some of the major protocols, because we think, you know, if we think there's a Web3 economy, then what are the key kind of pillars that hold it up? And we need to contribute to that. We need to contribute to the governance of those and the stewardship of those, you know. And so we've been active in Uniswap, and we're becoming more active in a number of other large protocols. And then we've also started thinking much more about like the product motion that we have for our products. What are different ways that can be opened up in a Web3 manner? What are the different paths that don't get us into regulatory trouble, but, you know, financialize our communities and incentivize our communities and so on?
Yeah, I saw just kind of on that note of DAOs and governance and people just playing a part in it. I did see something recently from the CFTC taking an action or some kind of public statement against one of these DAOs. I think it's called Ookie DAO, which it was the first time I had ever heard of it. And so it couldn't have been that big. But any light you want to shine on that before we kind of move on from that kind of topic?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't pretend to give legal or structuring or regulatory advice. I think out of the U.S. right now, there is a lot coming out of all the regulatory agencies. You know, the CFTC, which I do think that they did do a fine, if I remember. The SEC pursuing some folks for market making activities, which were essentially creating a fake market for their token, which, you know, kind of defrauds people out of their money, because you think you're participating in trading, but you're really being duped by a robot into losing your money. The OCC, which is the federal banking regulator, has become more conservative about stablecoins and bank, like federally chartered bankability to hold stablecoins, you know. And then you've got the stuff with the Treasury and Tornado Cash and so on. So I think that there's the volume of regulation and action, I think, has increased. Some of that is just lagging prior action, right? They're not going to move fast. They're going to be considered, and then they'll move. And they'll also move against things that are at the edges, you know. So there's no point punishing good actors. They're going to most likely look at, okay, who could be an example of a particular principle, you know? And so, whether we like it or not, we have to get through the grinder. I mean, like there's no path through the grinder other than through it. And my personal view is that like the mountain and the ocean, right? The ocean is going to erode the mountain. It's inevitable, but it might take time.
Yeah, and you know, I guess that's a perfect segue to kind of the last topic that I wanted to discuss with you. Was the Ethereum merge. And, you know, the Ethereum merge transitioned, you know, Ethereum from a $200 billion proof of work asset to a $200 billion proof of stake asset. And I kind of liken the engineering that went into the merge as like rocket ship engineering. It's like, you know, aerodynamic level precision that went into this transition. And, you know, one of the key things that I know Consensus has published about was the energy consumption has been reduced by 99.9%, which is extremely, extremely interesting and a net positive. But could you kind of walk us through from Consensus's point of view or from your point of view, you know, what the ethos of the merge is and the next vision for Ethereum 2.0? Is it just about the energy? I have a feeling it's not. There's something deeper probably afoot.
Sure. You know, I think you know, we're all, most of us are people and have feelings, and most of us are people and have feelings.
Some of us, like Elon Musk, are not people.
you never know. Anyway, I think, you know, Dick Cheney has a Darth Vader heart, so it's all complicated. Anyway, and so we can care about engineering and about numbers, and we can talk about how, you know, security for the Ethereum protocol is greater under proof of stake than under proof of work, because you know, like, more capital is required to do a 51% attack than if you were to, you know, acquire the miners or build out that capacity. So we can talk about that. We can talk about the supply side and the improvements. You know, security is cheaper, so you have to have, you're paying less for security, is there's less inflation. And so Ethereum becomes, from the supply side, can be a deflationary asset, meaning that there's less of it rather than more of it over time, unlike the US dollar. And we can talk about the carbon footprint in sort of numbers, right? So what does it really mean? Well, you're not cranking up graphics cards plugged into the electric socket to mine anymore. You are using digital capital in a digital mathematical equation to get returns, and everybody that wants to participate in that is not buying up hardware or again, you know, like, consuming electricity. And
it,
so
it kind of brings me back to what you were saying a bit earlier, sorry to interrupt, but about you saying the most interesting things are, like, you know, the digital native kind of advancements. And this really is what Ethereum, this 2.0 launch is. You know, it's an advancement from having, you know, exogenous forms of energy production to now it's all endogenous.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, if you kind of abstract a bit more, like, all this stuff is complicated math, right? Cryptography is complicated math with a 100-year history. Like, it's the state of the art for securing data and information. And the proof of stake mechanism, and then if you want to look at, like, ZK and privacy and all this stuff, end of the day, it's advances in applied mathematics, you know, and the outcomes of this are this reduction in the carbon footprint and so on. But I bring that up to say, actually, what people, I think, need right now is the story, and not a story to move market prices. That doesn't really work for very long, but a story to, like, organize. Again, I go back to this, to organize economic activity. And, like, we started with a really depressing, markets are down, pensions are this, inflation's that. Like, there's no good news, right? You're not going to get good news from the Fed. You're not going to get good news from Ukraine. You're not going to get good news from China. Like, we need a source of hope and good news, and we need a utopia towards which to drive. And even if the utopia is wrong in some way, that's okay, right? What you need is just, like, a motivation. Exactly. You need, like, we're going in this direction because it's going to be better in this way. And, like, yeah, it sucks in a lot of different places, but if you build here, if you work here, there are new kinds of rewards available. There are new kinds of communities. Like, you can belong to communities. You can be, you know, artists in a new way. You can build new types of businesses. You can get better returns. And now with this bit about the ESG impact, you're no longer compromising that vision with climate impact. And it doesn't matter if you believe or not believe the climate impact story and the mining story. And, you know, if folks on the Bitcoin side will continue to struggle with that narrative for better or worse, and it's not their fault, I think. but we're just removing that objection from the thousands or potentially millions of people who want to be NFT artists on Ethereum, who, you know, who don't have to go through contortions to participate in Web3, because they can use the, you know, the core chain, the mainnet chain, and not have a carbon footprint. And so for me, it's again, just kind of focusing all the energy in a place where there is a potential to grow a new economy. There's different types of property rights. There's different types of creativity. And I think the merge is demonstration that the protocol can deliver on that and open that up for people.
Yeah. And I did remember, you know, hearing all these folks talk about, you know, we love NFTs. We like the idea of having royalties, you know, automatically attached, but we hate the energy kind of component, you know, that it has. So there's now, you know, is it fair to call NFTs on Ethereum green, and ESG compliant?
Yeah, I think it is fair. I mean, when I email you a image, is that a green image in your email? I don't know. I don't think we necessarily need to. It should just be the default, right? That this is that modern blockchain technology, you know, doesn't have a negative climate impact, and that people shouldn't be prevented from contributing to it for that reason. You know, I think that skeptics will always find a way to be skeptical. There will be other reasons that people will create, and that's fine. I think that, again, if you look at Web3 over the last, let's say, 5 years, a lot of the things that were a problem in the beginning have been addressed. And then, of course, there's lots of things left for all of us to do.
Yeah. Well, why don't we talk about before we take off? Why don't we talk about CodeFi and staking? You know, CodeFi is something that you have been affiliated with. Can you tell us a little bit about this project?
Sure. I think I'll talk about it in this way. So, Consensus does a lot of protocol level work, meaning literally contributing code to protocols and helping the merge happen and so on. And so one of the things that we have is a project that helps institutions stake. So it's a software underneath the staking services that people use. It's not the only one. There's lots of other ones. And generally speaking, we want lots of staking providers. We don't want centralization of staking. Because that's an attack vector for the network. And so, you know, one of our projects is to support staking on Ethereum, and then, you know, helping institutions of different kinds, fully crypto native institutions, crypto exchanges, as well as more traditional institutions. Like, we want maximal interest in staking, and for technical teams that want a really secure and rigorous solution, that's what we provide there.
And Infura is another massive, fair to say, product line from Consensus. And I read an announcement recently that they're focusing on decentralizing their infrastructure, because right now it's maybe a little bit more centralized, another attack vector. Could you kind of paint us a picture of what the future of Infura might look like?
Yeah, so I've framed this a little bit before, right? Which is that across our products, we are thinking about what a Web3 motion looks like while continuing to be compliant and subject to all the sort of like right answers as it relates to regulation. And so there are things that we might like to do that we're not able to do. And if we did them, it would just break the industry. And so we won't. But there's lots of other things that we can do that can enable our communities and can give them more control and more participation in the core parts of the Web3 ecosystem. You know, like, There are many important protocols that are running on Infura. There are many important protocols that are running on Alchemy. You know, these companies today are organized in a Web2 fashion, but over time, they should become much closer to a Web3 organization. And that means, like, how do you think about the code base? Who runs the code base? Mm. Which parts of the code base? Some things can be decentralized and some things can't, because they might not be sufficiently performant if they're decentralized. And, you know, like, no amount of financial incentives is good enough if, like, your app doesn't load if you use a particular protocol because it's not running in the right way. So there's lots of substantive questions yet in terms of how we're designing a more decentralized Infura, but, you know, we wanted to signal to the ecosystem that this is something that we're doing, that we're working on it, and to open up for feedback and for participation from either people that want to run decentralized infrastructure as part of, you know, the group or the protocol, you know, or other infrastructure providers that would want to be partnered with us on this initiative.
Hey, somebody's got to be the pioneer, right? Kind of go where no man has gone. It looks like that's exactly what Consensus is doing. And kind of just to round things out, you know, I mean, this was killer, and I wish we could go longer. But, you know, as a guy who used to work at Lehman and Deutsche and Barclays, and now who's the head economist of, you know, arguably, you know, one of the largest crypto companies out there, definitely the largest Ethereum affiliated company. You know, what is just a word of wisdom to a new listener? Maybe this is his first time ever listening to a crypto podcast. His or her mind just got blown. What's one thing that you would tell them just to make their life a little bit easier here in the crypto world?
Curiosity is a virtue and novelty is a good guide, at least for me. Mm. You know, so I started my career in 2006 at Lehman. By 2009, I was done with Wall Street and had gone through a very foundational experience for me. Mm. that had a lot of lessons that look similar to where we are today. And I went into fintech and started building a company in the robo-advisor space in 2010, when it was quite early for that, and spent a whole bunch of time looking for novelty and following sort of the edge of what people were doing, trying to apply it rigorously to a pretty complicated industry. And, you know, after working in fintech for a little bit over half a decade, I switched more into research and then crypto and DeFi and Web3. And I think my decision process has very much been what feels like the most different and foreign and uncomfortable, and can I be curious about that? And if I'm curious about that, can I understand it? And if I understand it, can I imagine, if it's right, how can that thing be real? You know, because it's so easy to break things, it is much harder to build things. Mm. So, you know, I would encourage people to take that kind of maybe more artistic approach, more creative approach to the space, and figure out how you can add to it.
Yeah. One of the things I like to say is, like, you know, everything that's in reality kind of started from a person's imagination. And so don't be afraid to dream. Don't be afraid to think up of some crazy ideas and build it yourself, or partner with people that are doing increasingly novel things. So Lex, thank you so much for coming on the Crypto 101 podcast. If people enjoyed this conversation and they want to learn more about you or follow your work, do you have a Twitter or a Discord channel or anything that you could kind of point people to?
Yeah, lots of links. So check out consensus.net and download MetaMask, of course. For me, I'm like Twitter, and then I also write a weekly newsletter called The Fintech Blueprint. So you can just get that at fintechblueprint.com, and then I will talk at you in your email box every single week.
Awesome. What'd you say your Twitter handle was?
Lex Sokolin.
Perfect. All right, everybody. Look for those in the show notes. And I hope you guys have a great rest of your week or weekend whenever you're listening to this. We'll see you soon.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.